Glad to have you here, Rohit. I think first off, we just want to make sure, with everything that's going on in India, that you're staying safe. I don't know where you are at right now, where your family's at right now, and I really hope they're all staying safe.
Thank you. Yeah, they're safe. I was able to convince my mom to get vaccinated pretty early. So yeah, she's safe, and maybe I didn't convince, my wife convinced her to get vaccinated, because my wife's a virologist, so she actually works on COVID research. So I've been
Okay,
fairly
well.
up to date on all these things. And I'm based in San Francisco, so I'm in the Bay Area, and my family back in India is now listening to me more, to my wife more, and staying safe. So it's good.
That's great to know. That's great to know. Awesome. So yeah, let's get started. So you mentioned in an interview that you had to sleep on a Columbia alumni's couch for weeks. Was that sort of the trigger point which led you to start building Stilt? How did that happen?
Yeah, for sure. First of all, thanks for having me. Great that you guys are doing this. And just for anyone listening, they are super organized. They and they kept emailing and making sure we got together. So yeah, thanks for doing this for everyone who's not able to, listen to enough Bay Area people talking about stuff. So cool. First, I'll start with what Stilt is, and then give you a background on how the company got started. So we are a bank focused on immigrants. We provide them a lot of different products, including checking accounts, personal loans, remittance. We help them build credit in the US on day one. And our main focus is to democratize access to financial services for anyone moving to the US. They should be able to access quality and affordable financial services on day one of their arrival. So that's our primary goal. But when we started, coming to your question, the starting point was partially me sleeping on Columbia alum's couch for 4 weeks. And a little more background. So I moved to the US about 10 years ago, went for grad school at Columbia. And I, for the life of me, I could not rent an apartment, or I wasn't able to rent an apartment. Everywhere I went, landlords were asking me for credit scores, credit history, which in India is like CIBIL score. And if I didn't have that, they were asking for a 12-month deposit and like a whole bunch of other things that I didn't have. So I was constantly just banging against a wall and not able to rent an apartment. There was only one person who offered me an apartment, and that person eventually became my co-founder. So we became roommates because I wasn't able to rent an apartment. And
It's amazing.
when I was going through that experience, I at that time, it felt like everyone else was going through a similar thing. So it wasn't as what do you call it? It wasn't as different than anyone else. So it seemed like it's normal for people to face challenges.
So do you mean other international students that you knew?
Yeah, so there were a lot of other new students who were trying to do the same thing, and I found they were a lot more prepared than I was. So I the context of that is I basically decided in December of that year that I'll go to Columbia or I'll go to US next year. And so I had to like study everything in a month and a half. I took GREs, TOEFL, and all that stuff. And then my visa got stuck. I got RFE or 221G pink slip. So Colombia was starting on September 4th after, what's that called? Like July 4th, or after when the fall semester was starting on September 4th. And I got my visa on August 30th. So I flew on, I think, August 31st, something like that. So I just arrived in New York and the session was starting. So I didn't have any time to plan, and everyone was there like a month before to like do all of these things and, form bonds and rent apartments together and stuff like that. And I had none of those things, which actually turned out to be a blessing in disguise because of the
Of
people
course.
I ended up meeting later. But yeah, so as I was going through that experience, I obviously remembered that, but I also keep something I call an idea book, where I just write down things that I think should be done or challenges I'm facing or problems that I see in the world that can be solved. And that was one of the reasons, not finding an apartment was one of the reasons why I wrote this in my idea book, which many years later, when I was going through, I came back to and then tried to figure out a way to solve this problem. So that was one of the reasons, a long-winded way of saying that was one of the reasons why why we ended up starting Stilt.
And so when you talk to these landlords to rent apartments, for example, and you told them you were a Columbia student, they still didn't like let you rent an apartment? Is that what happened?
Yeah. So, I mean, I was ready with all my papers and stuff and, you know, I had admission letters and things like those, but at least they were not renting the apartment to me as an individual. In many cases, what I saw other people do is like they formed a group, everyone chipped in money for certain months of deposit and somehow they were able to rent an apartment that way. But it was very difficult to not possible without significant amount of money to rent an apartment as an individual.
So, wow, that's amazing. So now that you've mentioned, you know, that Stilt does all these awesome things, you talked about remittances, you talked about maybe debt and lending, all these different things. Is that, so what was the core offering that you started Stilt with? Was that just one of those things? Did you start, you know, tackling all these problems at once? What was the core problem that Stilt tried to solve?
Our first product was very simple. It was a personal loan for Indian Columbia grad students. That was all of our market. So it's like 200 people. And our loan was only available for people in New York, up to $25,000 and up to 16%. So, and why we decided that, like one way of thinking that we implemented Stilt is we constrain the problem so much that the solution is straightforward. Generally, when trying to build solutions, people run into this problem of feature creep because they try to build the best solution. And then as you continue to build it, you end up adding a lot more features, a lot more variations to it, and you want it to work for everyone. But our idea is like, we want the fastest time to launch. So we'll constrain the problem so much. We'll define the parameters of the problem so tightly that the solution is really straightforward. And in our case, if we were lending in New York at less than 16%, up to $25,000, that meant that we did not have to go and apply for expensive licenses, that we did not have to do a lot of other things. And doing it for Columbia students meant that we already had something pre-built in terms of network or people that we knew or someone, some population we can reach out to who is credit worthy enough and who needs money. So a combination of all those things meant that our first product was just like super constrained there. And as we continue to lend, as we grew from there, that's when we continue to expand and evolve the company.
So wasn't it sort of scary at first as an immigrant starting a company in the US? Like, what was that experience like? Especially because a lot of speaking as someone from India and the US myself, a lot of our visa statuses are dependent on employment, a long-term employment contract with another company. So what was that experience like? If you could talk about that.
So what I'm going to share, I should add the disclosure, don't try this at home. Because it was an extremely risky move on our part that worked out. And at the time we were doing this, it could have not worked out and then we would be in big trouble. So it could have gone either way. And then it's basically selection bias that it worked out. And then now I'm here talking about what happened. So starting a company as an immigrant is obviously problematic. People are on visas and visas have restrictions and stuff like that. So that, keeping aside, and by the way, like I'm not a lawyer and stuff, so just don't take my what I say on face value. Just go and also talk to professional lawyers and stuff. So But what we figured out at the time was you can actually start a company on a visa. You can't work for a company on a visa. You can't earn money. So the way I think the US government defines this is like if you are working for an entity where you draw part or most of your income and you spend X number of hours or you spend most of your time working on that, that's how they define whether you're working for that company or not, right? And me and my co-founder Priyank, we both had full-time jobs. And we registered the company, but we were not working for it. We were not making any money on it. So we were just lending to Columbia grad students at the time. And we had to figure out everything on our own, from registering the company to figuring out how can we start lending, to figuring out where do we get the money from. And all of those were risks at the time. Like we probably could have messed up working or starting our company and could have, you know, violated our visa requirements. We could have bought something else. We could have lost all the money that we lent out, which was from our own savings. When we started the company, we basically just gave loans from our savings. And my co-founder did that first, because that was the condition for us starting the company, because he had more money. I was like, well, you put money first and then I will put my money. So that's how we got going. And then eventually we got into Y Combinator. And that's when we decided to take this risk of sort of doing it full time. And the choice at the time we had to make was, do we let go of being a part of YC or and continue in our normal jobs, or do we become a part of YC and leave our normal jobs, our normal visas, and figure something else out to work full-time on the company? And that journey of leaving our visas to working full-time on the company was the riskiest move in our mind. And it's a new dimension of risk in addition to whatever challenges startups face. Immigrants face an additional challenge of this visa thing that just doesn't allow them to work on startups as freely as, let's say, the US citizen.
And so
population.
What year was this when you got into YC and had to decide between the company or YC?
2016.
So startups weren't as cool back then as they are today either. Like it wasn't.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, every year it's like startups are more cool every year. So in 2016, they were cooler than they were in 2014.
Yeah.
And 2021, they are cooler than they were in 2016. So I think the graph is just going up and into the right.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, so there's a couple of things I'd like to reiterate here. So mm-hmm. You use your own money to mm-hmm. lend out to mm-hmm. other people. And then you also had to make a decision as someone whose stay in the US was dependent on your job. You had to leave that job and then go into YC and work on still full time. Okay, so mm-hmm. yeah, for folks listening in, I guess that's what it takes sometimes at least, yeah.
I've also written about it in a blog post, like recounted the journey step by step, so mm-hmm. to speak. And I always mention the post name is Hard Work, Persistence, and Luck. And it's easy to discount the luck factor. If someone's working hard and is persistent, you get lucky, but it's totally possible that you don't get lucky.
Mm-hmm. And so what if you hadn't gotten into YC? What was your plan back then?
We would have probably continued on with our jobs and tried to make stills work on the side, or maybe stills would not have happened because we would not have that impetus, or we did not have that, you know, YC as a catalyst to help us really go towards building a company, because we didn't know anything about building a company at the time, and we would have just done it half of the time, or like part of the time with our full time jobs.
Was YC your first sort of I want to say seed capital, but also it wasn't really seed capital because your co-founder was sort of bankrolling the company.
Right.
Was YC your first raise, so to speak, or did you have other sort of investors join in earlier?
No, YC was the first equity capital in the company. And the the money we were using to lend was not equity capital. It was just lending capital in a way. So yeah, YC was the first equity money in the company.
Wow. So I guess, you know, that sort of touches upon a problem that I'm sure, I don't know if you probably experienced it as well. And I'm sure a lot of immigrants also experience, which is getting that first round of funding, mm-hmm. right? You come into a new country, you don't have all these connections, you don't have a network in this new country, but you have an idea and you think you can do it and you want to raise that first round of funding, your first mm-hmm. seed capital. Mm-hmm. What tips would you suggest for people, especially immigrants, who want to come in, build something and need capital to do so?
The tips are, I don't want the tips to be prescriptive in any way. This is just one way of building the company. And again, many for immigrants are not a homogenous group. They are a heterogeneous group. So international students is completely different than someone working full-time on a job and moving to the US. Not just because of the types of visas they are on or the obligations they have, but also the mentality that they have, the resources that they have, the freedom that they have, right? So if someone's an international student moving to the US, like they have a lot more freedom to work on a startup compared to someone who's on a full-time job, right? And the main thing that most people do, I think, is that they try to ask for permission more often than not. They are always trying to figure out how to minimize all the side risks of their startup versus executing on the core idea that will build their startup. As an example, when we were starting Stilt, we could have focused a lot on visa related issues, or, you know, we could have thought about more comfort that once we get the right visas or we have enough time or something like that, there could have been a lot of things that we could have chosen to focus on. We could have chosen to focus on figuring those out first before building the company, but we took the opposite route. We said that we want to build a company and we are going to build a company and we'll try and see what happens. And then we'll figure all the stuff out later. Right, and that's one main thing that people always need to remember, is to remove distractions that will not help them, or that won't help in building a company. You can't figure out everything when you start building a company. You can't figure, like, we have absolutely no idea what will happen to our visas if we start a company or if this thing works. The mentality was, if this thing doesn't work, then nobody cares anyways. If this thing works, then we'll figure it out. It's possible we probably, you know, we were able to figure it out, but it could have gone the other way as easily. But without the mentality of, yes, we will figure it out over time, you won't be able to build something. And as an immigrant, you'll have a lot of voices, you'll have a lot of people telling you to focus on different things, but the main thing you have to decide is whether you want to build a company or not, and then sidetrack all the distractions. And even though it seems like that immigrants are starting a lot of companies and all that stuff, there are larger number of immigrants who are not starting companies. So it's better to change your network or change the people that you are around who are focused on starting companies, rather than be with people who are focused on getting jobs. Because people who are focused on getting jobs will always try to make a case for why that's the best case scenario, or why that's the best thing to do, and not focus on building a startup. So A, like, don't ask for permission. Everything is allowed within certain framework, right? And so you just try and do something. And not seek permission of YC or anyone else to start that company. Second is to focus on starting company as the main thing, and then revolve other things around it, and believe that you will figure things out as things are happening. And that's the second piece. The third piece is to change your network to be amongst people who are focused on starting companies, who are starting companies, or who are other founders. That will give you a very different perspective than being around people who are more focused on jobs. So I think if you do these things, like rest of the stuff can be figured out. So you need to just make a two or three important fundamental decisions, and all the small decisions after that are easy, will become easy over time, just because of who you are talking to, where you are, and what your mindset is.
So going off of what you said about changing your network and being around people who want to build companies, was your interaction with Priyank, your co-founder, was that sort of how you guys bonded when you guys first met? Was that a common theme? And how did you go about following this advice, if you did, before or during starting Stilt?
Yeah, so when I was doing those things, I was totally not thinking in these terms. These are things that have formed in my head after I have done whatever I have done in the past, right? So when you're doing things, that's when you don't realize what you're doing. So one thing is that when I was at Columbia, I was always trying. So the advantage that I got from sleeping on someone's couch for multiple weeks and then finding a roommate was all my roommates were computer science students, and I wasn't computer science. I was operations research, and I was more into finance than computer science. And being with computer science students, A, meant that I could learn programming faster. B, I can potentially get them to build something. So, and I wasn't successful in doing any of those things at Columbia. So I didn't learn programming or enough programming at Columbia, and I wasn't able to convince anyone to build something with me. Every time I sat down with someone, I'm like, this is the idea. Can you, you know, build a website or do something on this? And they would say, they would spend 30 minutes to an hour on it, and then they're gone. Basically, next time it's a blank slate, and they are just focused on different things. So so at Columbia, I wasn't able to do much. Where I use this advice myself is I actually decided to move to the Bay Area. And the main reason for moving to the Bay Area was to be around people who are working in technology and building technology. So I really learned most of the coding that I know. I'm a very mediocre full stack programmer now. So most of the things I learned was working as a data scientist at a company here. And I spend a lot of time with engineering team, front end, back end, DevOps, whoever I can talk to. And I was programming on my own and then just using their help. And that worked a lot better than trying to convince friends at Columbia. And when my ex-roommate, my co-founder, moved to the Bay Area, that was one of the things we were doing, because that's what people do in Bay Area. If we were in LA, probably we'll all try to be actors in some form or fashion, because we are in Bay Area. Every conversation that you hear around you, every interaction you have, people you meet are all just focused on this aspect of work, which is like building startups in New York. It's finance. So that helped. And it was not as intentional. I had some broad idea in mind that if I go to Bay Area, I'll probably become a part of technology industry, but I did not know at the time that it will enable me to start my own company or how it will happen. But that, again, that fundamental decision was, okay, let me go to the Bay Area. I had nothing to lose. I could always move back to New York if things didn't work out. So yeah, this advice sort of, I implemented this advice myself.
And so when you were first starting Stilt, were you the programmer or was your co-founder the programmer? And sort of what were the steps you took before getting into YC? Like at what point were you in terms of the business itself when you got into YC? So how much were you lending, for example? How many users did you have at that point?
Yeah, so by the time we got into YC, we were doing maybe $100,000 in loans, something like that. And that was like, we had used up our savings. We were taking money from friends and stuff. So we were just constantly trying to grow the business. And I think we, within 2 months of doing this, we applied to YC and we got into YC like within a month after that, which was again surprising for us, which is again another totally fascinating movie type story that could not have happened if I have made one different decision, kind of thing. So it's very difficult to sort of redo the same steps or redo exactly the same thing, but directionally, we just kept building the business and applied to YC, $100,000 in loans, maybe 100 or so customers. We are a lending company, so the number of customers are not as high for us. The dollar volume matters more. So we were just doing that and just applied to YC, filled out the application form and continued to sort of build from there. And once we got into YC, then we raised more money and, you know, continued to raise multiple rounds of funding.
Do you want to dive into the story of YC and talk a little bit about that? I think everyone would be interested to hear that.
So this is where us, this is also partly a lesson is in thinking, in really, when we started the company, right? So we never thought that we could get into YC. We never thought we were good enough. We never thought our idea was good enough, or our company was good enough to get into YC. So we always thought of it as some far off dream-ish thing that may or may not happen, or we thought likely won't happen. So we applied to everything else, 500 startups, and I don't know, like whatever it was. And everyone else declined us. Only one person said yes to us, and that I don't know what it was, but they were asking us for money and equity to be a part of that. And I'm like, I'm never going to pay money to go here. We want money. We don't want to pay money. And then what we did, so it was like fall of that year. So we started the company, and then YC application window opened. And I filled out the YC application. I think I wrote the whole application like one night in office or something like that. And then it continuously iterated on it and always thought that application is not good enough. And this self-doubt and imposter syndrome, like all of those things are still on my mind. And at some point, 3 hours before the application deadline, I think application deadline was maybe either 8 p.m. or 11 p.m., one of those two times. And I was just like doing one final check on the application. And I became a part of this random Slack group from an event that I went to randomly. And they sent me an email. I'm like, yeah, I'll be a part of that Slack group. And I don't know why I was on that Slack group at that time. And that Slack group had nothing to do with YC, nothing to do with like FinTech and all that stuff. It was like a generic founder Slack group. And some YC founder, ex-YC founder, posted there that it's YC application deadline time. They have a few hours. They were free for a few hours, and they would help people improve their YC application before submission. And I, again, like so many things had to, you know, coincide for me to look at that message. And at that time, a few hours before the deadline, right? Like, and I sent my application to them, and they had, I don't know, they received a lot of responses. They picked 3 applications total from all those responses. And one of that was us. So they decided to spend an hour with me, mostly going through like iterating on the application and just fixing it. And I think they must have improved the application by 50% or something. Like all my stupid answers, they helped tighten. They're like, this information is not good. Like add numbers here, whatever they did. I don't know. I may have access to that Google Doc somewhere. But because of their improvements, our application became much better. And I got a sense of, okay, what I need to improve there. And we were one of those 3 applications. And of those 3 applications that they helped, only we got in, right? So that was first crazy thing that happened, that No, I could not have expect, I could not have planned for it. That was the first part. Second part is like, so we submitted the application after, even after improvements and stuff, I'm like, we are not gonna get in. And this was around Diwali time. This was before Diwali, like a month before Diwali, sometime in October, I think. And my dad used to run a business in India, and I always like I grew up helping him run the business. So Diwali time is a busy time for us. So I was planning to go home 2 or 3 days before Diwali to actually help him for a week or so. I mean, took days off and stuff. And I booked my ticket, and then YC interview deadline or interview date comes along, and it's 3 days after my flight. So now I'm thinking, and by the YC interviews are 10-minute interviews, right? So I may be missing the dates, but it was like November 6th or November 9th kind of situation. And so we got YC interview, and then again I'm thinking we are not going to get in. So at the time I'm thinking, so the interviews go on for like a month, month and a half, right? And I'm going to India for a couple of weeks, and they do interview in two, or at the time they were doing it in two slots, like 15 day and then 15 day or something like that. And I was like, okay, I can go to India, I can come back, and then I can pick a slot at the last of the last dates and interview then. But I don't know, we were looking at data or something like that. A, we figured out our chances of getting accepted were about 1 in 5. So I'm like, it's YC generally accepts 1% of the applicants, or 1% of applicants get into YC. So I'm like, okay, our chances have 20x'd or so already. So do we want, so it's way better. So that's one. The second thing we figured out was YC accepts more companies from the first half than the second half, because it's a rolling thing. So they continue to accept companies as they come along. And then we're like, okay, then going at the end doesn't like reduces our chances that we have 1 in 5 chance. We don't want to make it 1 in 6, 1 in 7, right? And then I'm like, okay, so maybe we can do the interview in the first half, but now I'm looking at ticket prices. So I want to change my ticket, and it was costing me somewhere around like $1,000 or something like that to a like change fee and the differential ticket price. And YC interview is 10 minutes. So I'm doing this math in my mind, like $6,000 an hour for YC interview. I don't want to do that. And then I don't know why or somehow we convinced, we're like, okay, we'll interview on the first day then, because I want to go home for Diwali. And it was like, we did interview on the same day, then I would land in India on the day of Diwali. Kind of, because I had already taken days off and stuff like that, so I thought maybe I'll just, you know, make the trip, because I think I wasn't able to make that trip last year, and or the year before that. And so we booked the we then we decided to do the interview, and then we scheduled the interview for 3 p.m. and my flight is the same day at I think 9 p.m. or 8 p.m. or something like that. And we go to the first interview at 3 p.m. They interviewed us. Generally, it's one interview, but in our case, they decided they want to interview us again. And the second interview will be after all the other interviews are done, which was like 6 p.m. or something like that. And now I'm watching my clock. I'm like, I have to catch a flight at 8 p.m. or 9 p.m. And they want to interview me again. And so we are. I'm just pacing around. We're waiting around and all that stuff. And I think at 5:30 or 6, they called us again for the second interview, and they told us that they'll let us know by 7 p.m. via call if we got in, and if we didn't get in, then they'll send us a message. So now I'm at the airport at 7, and I'm watching the clock at 7:15, 7:30, and all this stuff. And at 7:40, 45, I'm like, we definitely didn't get in. So I went to get my boarding pass. And funnily enough, as I get my boarding pass, 30 seconds later, I'm getting a call from my co-founder, and I internally know that we got in. That's why he's calling. Otherwise, he wouldn't have called. He would have texted. So suddenly, I have my boarding pass, and I'm going in the security line, and I got that call that we got into YC, and that was the best flight ever for us. And then I was like, maybe I should go to India. Maybe I should just cancel my flight, or what should I do? That was like the whole thing that happened. I mean, yeah, the story was pretty long, but multiple things happened, and none of those things can have could have been predicted, designed, you know, we could have, we wouldn't know even like a day before that all these things would happen that would end up us getting into YC. So that was the long story of how we got into YC, just, you know, by the smallest margin.
I think that's phenomenal. I have no words. I think there's so many things there that, I don't know. I'm very dumbfounded, obviously, because you mentioned that a lot of it is luck, but I also think that a lot of it is your hard work and perseverance, which led to this luck. It's always, you know, it's because you attended that event that day, and that's why you were part of that Slack in the first place, and then you just end up being lucky. So, you know, it is luck, yes, but luck is a function of hard work.
No, 100%. What most people don't realize is and I think it's maybe a Jeff Bezos thing, is that they don't think in terms of, what does he call them?
It's a regret minimization framework. Is that what you're
talking about? No, it's about the inflection points in life. I'm not able to remember the exact term, but it's, most people don't realize that every action they take, even it may have a very low probability of succeeding, but the payoff is so huge that it's worth doing all of those really small things. And a lot of people don't spend enough time doing things that can have huge payoffs in their lives. And they tend to like live in averages. So they do the average daily thing and nothing much. So it's sometimes you are into working out or you exercise, and one day you don't feel like exercising, and then you're like, today I'm not going to the gym, I'm gonna go stay home. If you don't do that, then the impact on your life theoretically is not as significant. You can start going to the gym again, and then something will happen, right? And then you'll be back on track. But in working in startups and doing things that have amazing, huge payoffs, you need to make sure that you are getting up and giving your best every day, because you don't know if you miss out on that one day of going to gym is the event that could change your life, right? Me going to that one event after work is one of the reasons it changed our lives, right? And in my story, I told the part of how we got into YC. If we go into the prep part of it, like there was so much luck there too. Like my co-founder got to meet someone at some event or through some connection, this guy, Praful, who was also XYC founder, and he helped us immensely in preparation. He was like traveling and stuff, but he still got on calls with us and then helped us a lot in terms of making our answers airtight, making us like really prepare for the interview. And if that hadn't happened, maybe we would have botched the interview, right? And we had no idea who he was like a week or two before we were supposed to interview for YC, right? And all those things are important, and that's why it's worth keeping in mind at all times that every small thing, every low probability thing that you are doing in startup world can have amazing payoffs, and you don't know at the time whether they will or not. And that's why you need to give 100% to all the low probability things that can change your life.
There's a wonderful book about this. I think it's by Annie Duke is her name, I believe. It's called Thinking in Bets.
Right.
And that always gets to me. I think a lot of founders who we talk to always talk about how we should always be doing things with which have asymmetric opportunities, right?
That's the term, asymmetric opportunities. Yeah, asymmetric advantages. Yeah.
Right. And you always need to be doing things that have limited downside but infinite upside potential. And that will eventually, you know, those bets accumulate, and then one of them will pay off, and now you're infinitely better off.
Right. And Guy Kawasaki, who was at Apple in the early days, he also calls it planting the seeds. You do a lot of different types of things, and maybe one of those things will work out. So it also important to think in terms of different dimensions of doing things. This, honestly, this podcast or interview is one of those things. Like, it's something that I won't normally do, and I don't do. The last thing I did was I was speaking at Harvard Business School Angel Conference, right? And on a panel. And these are so different things that as of now, I don't know if A, this will be helpful to someone, B, like it will be helpful to me in some way, if maybe people get to know about still or something like that. But it's something significantly different than what I do on a day-to-day basis that can potentially result in a lot of benefits, but has absolutely no downside to me, except me spending an hour with you amazing people.
Absolutely.
So is your writing also a form of taking advantage of these asymmetric opportunities? Is that a way to sort of get your ideas across to a wider audience that you otherwise might have access to?
Partially, yes. And again, like, this is a realization that happens. I'm constantly surprised myself by the reach that my writing has, by the number of people who reach out to me or people who have read stuff. Like, I've been paid by a hedge fund once to give them expert opinion on something. And like, I'm an expert of nothing. And they somehow found my writing. This is a hedge fund in New York. And this is one of my favorite hedge funds that I track. I track their positions, and they invest in technology companies long-term and stuff like that. And they reached out to me, and they're like, they want to talk to me because they think that I know something about fintech. And first I was surprised, but then I realized, like, someone read my analysis of some company, forwarded it to them, because I'm sure, like, I have not even 1,000 subscribers on my Substack. So it's not like it's super popular. But the reach is significant, and then I receive messages from people. So that's one. The second is, I was just getting the same questions from a lot of people, and I, in order to save some time for myself and for it to be available to what the wider population, I just, if I'm asked the same question multiple times, I just write it down now in a post and just send them the post.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. So I think we want to dive a little bit into Stilt and maybe some of your writings as well that sort of talk about fintech. So where is Stilt at today? How do you see sort of Stilt growing in the next 5 years, for example? What is your vision for Stilt?
At Stilt, we are trying to provide quality and affordable financial services for folks who don't have access to it. We started with immigrants as the first market, and we are building products that immigrants need from the day they arrive in the US throughout their lifetime of being here or going back to their home country, whatever they end up doing. And the long-term vision is to be an account or to be a fintech company that immigrants, once have access to, they don't have to open an account again. So once they open an account with Stilt, we should be global enough, we should be big enough that if someone's moving from US to Canada or, you know, amongst all these countries, they should be able to just continue with their Stilt account wherever they are in the world. They don't have to build credit again. They don't have to worry about getting access to credit again. And they don't have to worry about like checking accounts and things like those. So long-term, we want still to be the bank of this population that's probably immigrant population or nomadic population, and then just continuously expand from there to serve folks who are currently not served by existing financial institutions. And then hopefully we can add some value to their lives. Funny story here is that Bank of America actually started as Bank of Italy, based out of San Francisco in 1904, and started by giving loans to Italians in San Francisco after the great earthquake or the big earthquake that happened here. And now it's the one of America's largest banks. And originally it started as by serving immigrants. So we hope to have similar trajectory in terms of our company where we serve immigrants today, but it continue to evolve with much better product for everyone out there.
That's a great analogy. I really like that analogy. That's awesome. So one other thing that I want to talk about, especially which is relevant today with all the hype around cryptocurrencies. So do you foresee crypto being a part of at still right, like in the future? Do you foresee crypto, especially because, you know, you are in the space of remittances, which is a great, great use case for crypto. How do you foresee sort of that evolving at Stilt?
Yeah, so we keep track of crypto. My co-founder is more into it than I am. We have, through YC community, a lot of founders who are into crypto. So we keep up to date on, or we keep pace with innovation in the space. But I think Stilt is not a company that will innovate on something fundamental in crypto. We will be users of crypto to enable different financial services. So as DeFi, decentralized finance is happening, I'm trying to understand that and see how can it be implemented at Stilt to make services even more affordable and low cost, including remittances. So those types of things are totally in our wheelhouse, both now and in the future, and we will implement those as it makes sense for us.
Sort of more on the operational side of things, how has Stilt grown, say, in the last 4 or 5 years since you started? And what has that experience been like? How have you hired? What have you focused on? And how have you dealt? I'm sure there are some regulatory challenges associated with the financial industry. So how do you navigate around those challenges as well?
A lot of building a company is a lot of things we do in life, and I just, not just building the company, but other things too, I call them method acting. Like, we are all just trying to be the character that in a real life. I didn't know how to run a company before I started still, right? And I'm seeing what other people are doing. I have some my ideas of my own, and then I just try to do the best I can with a combination of these two things. So the same principle is applied in hiring, in terms of defining products, in terms of dealing with regulatory and financial issues. We didn't know anything about regulatory and financial issues when we started the company, but we read statutes ourselves because we didn't have money to pay to lawyers. So, and that actually became a good thing because now we are fairly well, we are fairly knowledgeable about whatever, how compliance impacts the company and whatever's happening here. So we don't use lawyers or other people as a crutch and then just being, you know, pushed around depending on a lawyer's inclination. So all of those things we have figured out over time. And there are many things that we don't know that we'll continue to figure out from here on also. Moving forward, we want to hire a lot more people. We want to grow the company even bigger. In person in San Francisco before the pandemic happened, then we completely went remote. So we had to learn how to like work more remotely now that no one's in the office, which is both a positive and a negative. I don't get to see how many people are at the company in one place aside from our weekly meetings when I just see everyone's faces. But being in person for that many people would have been fascinating for me. Now we are 25 people total at the company, but I had never thought that I'd start a company and be able to hire 25 people working with us on one goal. And that's a fascinating experience. 5 years ago, I was just another one of the employees at other companies doing, you know, one part of the job. And I keep all those things in mind to make sure that we are being better than what I had experienced. And I add my own understanding to it. So employees are always have, you know, every week they know everything about the company. They know what we are thinking. They are able to reach out to me with any problem or anything that they want to talk about, any ideas that they want to implement. And we try to make it incredibly simple for them to basically work at still, like just share like a virtual card with everyone. They can spend money on whatever, have absolutely no restrictions. If someone misuses it, then we will add restrictions. But if someone wants to pay for a tool to make their lives easier, I don't want them to go through an approval process to buy that tool. And it wastes my time, it wastes their time. And we expect people to use judgment in that. And that's also one of the core values. So we have to like figure out a lot of these things, and we are building a company based on how we think it should work. And a lot of it is just us learning things as they happen, as the company gets bigger, as we raise more money and stuff like that.
Yeah, I've read multiple quotes from this PM at Stripe, Shreyas Doshi, who says that culture eats tactics for breakfast. And so I feel like the fact that you don't have this long drawn out approval process for example, some learning course that someone might want to take, I think that's great. That's a sign of a company that's really moving fast and doing well by its employees as well. So that's really great to hear.
Yeah.
One sort of, let's say, it's not really related to Stilt per se, but are you keeping pace with the Indian entrepreneurship ecosystem? Are you still in touch with friends from India? Any of your, college friends, what are they doing and what it's like in India right now?
Yeah, so I also know a couple of people who went back to India to start companies who were in the US with me who were with me at Columbia, right? And there's a company in India called Dunzo. I don't know if you've heard of that. That person
we ordered from Dunzo.
Oh, okay, that person was a roommate, right? Like that guy was my roommate at Columbia. And who would have thought like he would go to India and start this incredible company, Dunzo? He was always hardworking and stuff and always trying new ideas. And now when I think back, I can totally see the types of people who basically end up starting companies. But more or less, those are the people that I know usually. And I also know YC founders who are doing companies in India. So I get to know a little bit through that. I don't necessarily try to actively keep pace. It's only through osmosis or talking to friends who have started companies back home.
And so for you talked about global expansion also. So any plans for opening a Stilt office in India? Because a lot of immigrants are Indians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have employees in India. So a couple of our team members are in India. We don't expect to open an office anytime soon. One thing that we are doing as of now is we are hiring, we are keeping all synchronous functions in the company in the same time zone. Synchronous functions are functions that require us to collaborate in real time and to sort of make sure that we are functions that require a lot of collaboration and iteration are the functions that will be in the same time zone. Engineering and some other functions are in that category. So we'll keep those functions in the same time zone, and then asynchronous functions that can be done on its own time, doesn't require a lot of real-time collaboration, can be in different time zones. So some of marketing functions, finance functions, other functions can be in India and other countries. So in those functions, we don't expect to hire a lot more people. Or a lot of people. So as of now, we have no plans for like really opening a big office in India or something like that. But who knows? You know, things change all the time. And I should remember all the previous things that have happened in our company's journey. That one thing changes, like we hire one rock star engineer in India, and then we like we really want to hire this person. And we'll build everything around this person. So that may result in office in India. Who knows?
Cool, that's amazing. This is unrelated and more on a personal note. Mm-hmm. If there's one problem that you could solve and money wasn't an issue, Would you solve another problem? Would you continue to invest more in the problem you're solving right now? A bit of both.
Yeah, no, so I also the problem we are solving is sometimes I think of them as like really enabling immigrants to have a bigger impact on the world. And if you think of all the innovation that has happened, especially in the US in the past 50 years or so, most of that innovation has come from immigrants or their children, right? Like, so if US
Correct.
hypothetically did not have any of these immigrants moving to the US, then it won't be US. It would be some other country that nobody wants to go to, right? So I do think that immigrants have a disproportionately high impact on the world, and allowing them to really make that impact, making their life easier so they can focus on, creating that impact is a mission worth pursuing and should be there for the long term, because they are really going to change lives. They are really going to improve the pace of innovation and all that stuff, all that good stuff that comes with technology. But if I were not working on still like the climate change is one area that I'm, for my personal curiosity, I research, and that includes both in terms of like how we can use just normal different business models to allow people to contribute to lowering carbon emissions or something like that, or impacting climate in a positive way. Also includes carbon sequestration, carbon capture technologies, better ways of using better alternatives to carbon producing products and stuff like that. So that's one area. And the second, because of my wife, I've also gotten to understand more biotech, and that's another area that I, as I explore just through talking to her or just learning from her, is another one where I think it'd be we are understating or underestimating the impact that it will have in the next, let's say, not in a couple of years, but like 10 to 15 years. A lot of great companies will be built in this space, and a lot of innovation that will improve the overall health of the world will come from the biotech sector.
And who knows, maybe some immigrants will take a loan from Stilt and maybe use that capital to start their own companies in biotech and climate change.
One of my hopes is that one of our customers actually ends up building a billion-dollar company, which is on its way, by the way.
Oh,
Funnily
wow.
enough, a YC founder was a Stilt customer before he was a YC founder. So he took a loan from
That's
us,
amazing.
and then I don't know, we helped him in some way with the loan, and then he went to YC and he's doing his company, and that's doing great. He's gonna raise probably like another big round of funding soon, and we really hope that the company becomes successful so we can be like, okay, we at least enabled one Stilt customer to start a billion-dollar company.
One and many more to come. Thank you,
Yeah.
Rohit. Thank you so much. This was amazing. Thank you so
Thank
much.
you. Thanks a
For
lot.
sure. Thanks for having me.